All right, you may proceed.
May it please the court. Good morning. My name is Robert Lofton from McGuire Woods on behalf of the appellant, RGR LLC. With me at counsel's table are my co-counsel, Virginia Bondurant and Charles Williams. I plan to address RGR's five assignments of error in three topics. First, RGR did not owe Mr. Settle a duty. Second, Mr. Settle's contributory negligence, not RGR's lumber pile, was the proximate cause of his death. And third, the trial court erred in applying Mrs. Settle's $500,000 settlement with Norfolk Southern to the jury verdict rendered against RGR. First, with regard to the issue of duty, context is essential. Whether a duty exists is a question of law that the trial court was required to determine in the first instance. This court has held that there's no such thing as negligence in the abstract or in the general. Negligence must be in relation to some person. The failure of the trial court and of Mrs. Settle to establish the relationship of the parties, the character of the crossing, and the lack of notice or knowledge to RGR all combined to confirm that RGR did not owe a legal duty to Mr. Settle. First, with regard to the relationship of the parties, Mrs. Settle makes reference in her brief before this court to RGR as a business entity. But she failed to allege or present any evidence at trial of Mr. Settle's status on the private road or any evidence of Mr. Settle's relationship to RGR, Norfolk Southern, or the owner of the private road, Wolf Realty.
Well, this is not a premises liability case.
No, Your Honor, it's not.
So we've got case law, Rice being one of those cases, that says that as an owner or possessor of land, you can't use it in such a way as to cause harm to others.
And yes, Your Honor.
That's a common law principle.
Yeah.
So why wasn't that the appropriate duty here? And that's what the trial court found. It's reflected in the jury instruction.
Yes, Your Honor, that is what the trial court found, and that is how the jury was instructed. But Rice is different from the facts of this case, in that Rice involved a public road. Here we're talking about a private road.
But the common law doesn't necessarily turn on public road, private road. It's talking about adjacent land and people using adjacent land.
Yes, it does, Your Honor. That is correct. But in understanding a duty that RGR would owe as a tenant on adjacent property to a third party who is on another's private property, you have to understand the relationship between the parties, first and foremost. And secondly...
Well, you've got a possessor of property and someone using adjacent property. That's the relationship.
Well, assuming that is correct, Your Honor, I would submit that you still have to determine the status of Mr. Settle on the property, whether he's a licensee or an invitee, because that will go...
On the adjacent property? Why is that relevant?
Well, that will go
that makes to... It, that turns it into a premises liability case.
Well, no, I don't think it turns it into a premises liability case. I think it helps articulate what the duty is that RGR owed to Mr. Settle.
So are you saying that there'd be a difference if Mr. Settle was a licensee or an invitee on the adjacent property?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, articulate the difference in those two duties, please.
Well, if Mr. Settle, if Mr. Settle was a licensee, he takes upon himself the ordinary risks of the crossing. And whereas if he's an invitee, arguably the owner of the property, Wolf Realty, had a duty to Mr. Settle to inform him of the
That may all be true, but we're talking about whether RGR had a duty in the use of its property to people on adjacent property.
Yes, Your Honor. So, but in terms of the distinction, if Mr. Settle is merely an invitee, there was no duty, and I'll jump ahead to proximate causation and contrib, there was no duty to warn Mr. Settle what Mrs. Settle admits in her brief was an open and obvious danger.
Well, let's turn to your argument about his contributory negligence. Because your argument is that he was contributory negligence as a matter of law.
Yes, Your Honor.
Which means that there weren't sufficient facts or disputed facts even to go to a jury.
Correct, Your Honor.
Part of proximate cause, or part of contributory negligence, there's three elements, and one of them is proximate cause. So I'm going to walk you through this and tell me why this wasn't a jury question. The edge of RGR's lumber stack was 23 feet from the center of the track, and the track was 5 feet wide. That's between the metal rails. The edge of RG's lumber stack was thus 20.5 feet from the edge of the rail closest to Mr. Settle. The front of his truck extended 8 feet from the cab. These are all facts that were stipulated or weren't controverted. So at the point when he passed the edge of the lumber stack, the front of his truck would have been, in the best case scenario, about 12.5 feet from the edge of the rails. He's into that 15-foot zone that we had testimony about. There was testimony that he was driving 5 miles an hour, and the parties agreed that at 5 miles an hour, he would have traveled 7.33 feet per second. So the trial court took judicial notice of his reaction time of 1.5 seconds. So at 5 miles an hour, he would have traveled about 11 feet in the time for it took him to be aware that the train was coming. That's his reaction time. And then because of the load of the truck and the kind of truck he was driving, it took about 10 more feet for him to stop. And at that point, he is about 21 feet. So he gets hit. Now, why aren't those sufficient facts to let a jury decide whether or not, if he was negligent, whether his negligence was a proximate cause of the accident?
Well, I think those facts are very similar to the fact pattern that this court was presented with in Sugarland. In Sugarland, the transformer boxes that were at issue were 10 to 15 feet back from the road. Here, Mrs. Settle has admitted, and the stipulations that you've read were clear, that Mr. Settle had 12.5 feet between the edge of the
There was no testimony in Sugarland that this young man, I think it was a young man coming down on the bicycle,
yes, ma'am.
That his vision was blocked, that he couldn't see the road.
Right, and here there was affirmative testimony from Mr. Compton, who is a colleague of Mr. Settle's, that he drove across the private crossing and that he had room to see oncoming train traffic around the lumber pile, that he had the opportunity to stop.
I agree with you. That makes it disputed. That's why it goes to the jury. And the jury made its call here. You're asking us to rule as a matter of law, which means that no reasonable fact finder could have found what they found here.
Yes, Your Honor. And here, looking at Sugarland and looking at how the crossing and how Mrs. Settle agrees that the crossing was arguably an open and obvious danger.
There's no question about it. It was there for everybody to see. But even though it was open and obvious, you've got to take what was there and how he handled it and tell me as a matter of law that his failure to, if we accept that he didn't look, was a proximate cause.
And as a matter of law, in the context of a railroad crossing, where this court has consistently held that the tracks themselves are a proclamation of danger, Mr. Settle was required to look and listen where such looking and listening would be effective.
But I just pointed out to you, because of all these facts, that at the point when he could have seen, he couldn't have stopped.
Well, the evidence before the jury was that he did not stop. He proceeded past the lumber pile onto the railroad tracks. And that, as a matter of law, in the context of a railroad crossing, whether a public crossing or a private crossing, but I think especially a private crossing, when he failed to stop, that's contributory negligence as a matter of law.
Well, now, that may be, as a matter of law, negligence, but you've still got to have the proximate cause.
Right.
Because even if he had stopped, once he could see around the lumber track, there was a curve in that track. I think the site distance was 800 feet. The train was going 45 miles an hour, so it was traveling 66 feet per second. So in the time that if he didn't see a train and started to move forward in this truck because of the shifting of the gears, it's still a jury question as to whether he could have gotten across, even if he'd stopped and there was no train.
Well, in that,
your point is that he didn't stop, and that's why he couldn't get across in time.
Exactly.
Now, when you stated the duty was to look and listen, I thought the duty was to stop, look, and listen.
Well, this court has never affirmatively said that there is a requirement to stop unless you are unable to ascertain whether a train is coming. And so in this context, given the open and obvious danger of the lumber pile, Mr. Settle and the testimony of RGR's expert was that under the facts of this case, given the lumber pile, given Mr. Settle's possession of the CDL, given Mr. Settle's familiarity with the crossing, given the warnings that Mr. Settle received from his employer about the crossing, Mr. Settle did in fact have an affirmative duty to stop. before crossing. And if, and you know, Mrs. Settle characterizes the crossing as dangerous to go, dangerous to stop. And under the, if that is in fact the case, it is not reasonable for Mr. Settle not to stop. Mr. Settle had a duty to stop before proceeding. And if there were questions or concerns or problems with the crossing, Mr. Settle could have raised those to his employer. The testimony was that that never happened. His employer could have raised those to RGR. There was no notice to RGR, to go back to the duty issue. There was no notice, whether actual or constructive, either that the lumber pile was in Norfolk Southern's right-of-way at the time of the accident, and there was no notice that that type of obstruction created a danger or hazardous condition.
Well, if it was open and obvious, was it an open and obvious to RGR just like it was to Mr. Settle?
Not necessarily, Chief Justice Kinzer, because this was a private road and a private crossing. There's no evidence that RGR had permission to use the private road or crossing. There was no evidence that RGR had ever been on the private road or the crossing. But there was evidence that from two of Norfolk Southern safety inspectors, they viewed the lumber and did not see it as a problem. There was evidence from an individual who owned a business on the other side of the tracks that he noticed the lumber for at least 12 years, for as long as he had had his business there, had never complained about it. Ryder was aware of the lumber and had never complained about it to RGR. In the absence of actual or constructive notice, there's no duty to RGR. So going back to whether Mr. Settle was a licensee or an invitee, if this court holds that there was a duty, the duty of ordinary care that the jury was instructed, whether relying on Overstreet or just generally, RGR still had to be on notice, and there was no evidence at all that RGR was on notice.
But let me ask you something. Given the facts that the Chief Justice just gave you concerning, as he approaches the tracks and he clears the lumber pile on the right-hand side, if he's going 5 miles an hour, even if he sees a train, he can't stop. Isn't that exactly the evidence that indicates that if he doesn't stop, he's contributorily negligent?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, I mean, it seemed like you were saying a lot of other stuff when it seems like it's pretty directly follows from the facts, because given the facts as read by the Chief Justice, if he doesn't stop, that's the same as not looking. Any train coming from the right is going to hit it, because by the time he sees it, if he doesn't stop, he's going to hit the train.
Correct, Justice Goodwin. In responding to Justice Lemons's question, I was inarticulate. I apologize. But Mr. Settle, under the facts of this case, given the nature of this private crossing, Mr. Settle had an affirmative duty to stop, and he failed to do so. And therefore, as a matter of law, he was contributorily negligent.
And if he'd stopped, given the sight distance and the truck he was driving, and he didn't see a train, could he have gotten over the tracks before the train hit him?
Possibly.
We don't know that.
But the reality, and I think you're missing, not missing a point, but the reality is, to his right, he could see the train. He could have seen this train and avoided this train because his sight line to the right was 600 feet. And given the speed of the train, there's 9 seconds he would have to stop.
Correct, Justice Cooper.
It was trains coming from the left, which was unobstructed, that he would have difficulty with when he tried to take off and cross the track.
Right.
After stopping, is my understanding of the fact.
Yes, Justice Cooper. He, under the facts of this case, if he had stopped, he would not have been hit by the train. So I'll reserve the balance of my time.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Robert Sincar. I'm with Kevin Laughlin, and we represent Georgia Settle. We are here on a challenge to a motion to strike and to set aside the verdict. Those were both rulings that the court made below and declined to grant the defense motions. And in both situations, material facts were in dispute or there was evidence to support the verdict. And so the court's rulings below were just perfectly legal. problem that RGR has here is to try to convert those into a legal issue. And it is not true that as a matter of law, Charles Settle had a duty to stop for several reasons. First of all, I would direct the court to the jury instructions. The jury instructions on the proper duty here were RGR's jury instructions. They proposed them. And those jury instructions...
Is it, you're talking about 11B now? Because that was not exactly right. They really opposed any instruction on that duty, but they said, if we have to choose one, we'll take 11B over 11A. And that's not what you said in your brief.
Well, I was talking about contributory negligence right okay. now, Your Honor. But to answer your question, number one is 11B is an accurate statement of the law of the legal duty that applies here. And that is the duty to use your property. And property there, by the way, does not mean it's not limited to real property. It is all forms of property. And so you see, in this court's cases, you have a valve in a tank car that was negligently maintained. That's the Standard Oil case. The operation of a bulldozer.
Well, hold up. Let me stop you. Because it seems like to me the problem is all the cases you cited, and you should go through them, every one involves an instance where the property which was used or maintained caused physical injury. It wasn't because it obstructed somebody's vision and seeing something. It's because, like in the rail car, there was an explosion.
Right.
It blew up and people got hurt. Your next one, it was a bulldozer that hit somebody. Your next one, it was a cow that was in the road and they ran into the property, the cow.
Yeah.
Where do you have a case where we have found there was a duty to not place something on your property so that someone else couldn't see around the curve or...
The duty involved here, Your Honor, is the duty to not use your property in a way that unreasonably endangers someone. Right here, this whole case was premised on the notion that by preventing a driver approaching this crossing, the time to perceive and react to a train, you are creating a danger. All those cases are just particular instances of danger that's created.
Well, do you have a single case that fits your scenario?
Do I have a single case that...
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't involve the property that we're talking about causing actual physical injury.
The property here is the lumber pile, Your Honor. This
right.
is not a real
He didn't hit the lumber pile, and the lumber didn't fall on it. All these other cases you talk about,
in the Southern States grain case, that was a case involving a hoist in a grain storage.
Right.
And there, the property was a truck that fell on the truck driver because the fellow who was running it didn't warn him.
Right, the property fell on somebody.
Right, so that fell on him.
The wood piles didn't fall on anybody.
Those are all examples of danger. The rule is not that you have to, that there are only certain specific forms of danger.
Well, I'm just asking you, find me a case. We've got about, 300 years of jurisprudence that fits your scenario where we have found that someone was liable because their vehicle obstructed someone's sight or because their property obstructed someone's sight.
Well, there are cases from other jurisdictions. I don't
know. I'm asking about Virginia.
Yeah, I know. That's why I'm saying.
I think the answer is no. But go ahead.
But my point, Your Honor, with respect, is that sort of beside the point. Because the rule of law is you can't use your property to create a danger. Here, the danger was obstructing the sight of Charles Settle as he was trying to cross this track.
Let me ask you a question, because I thought of this as I was driving in Richmond. You get to an intersection, and there is a right-of-way, correct? Five houses down, somebody has parked on that right-of-way. Now, in order to get through this intersection, as I'm trying to cross it, I got to creep up and look. And you're telling me the law in Virginia is, if I creep up and somebody hits me, I can sue the person who parked their car four or five houses down because they obstructed my vision? They were negligent to park there, to put their property there?
You know, Your Honor, to a certain extent, the exchange we're having illustrates our point that the rule of law here is you have a duty not to create a danger with your property. After that, the particular facts matter. And with respect, Your Honor, the jury here found that Charles...
Well, let me ask you that, though.
If I may just directly answer your question, please.
I don't think you're doing it, but go ahead. Do the best you can.
I think I can do pretty well, Your Honor.
All right.
The problem,
I'm listening.
The problem here is that trains came from both directions. I think the thrust of Chief Justice Kinzer's questions illustrate that. The predicament that Charles Settle had on that day is that trains came from both directions at an unscheduled time. 12.5 feet from the rail is considered, even by RGR's expert, the danger zone. So it cannot be the law that you required someone to stop in a dangerous position. That is an unheard of proposition. There's no case supporting that. There's no authority for it. The law is that someone has a duty to look and listen effectively, and that's jury instructions P and R in Joint Appendix 164, 165, and those were their jury instructions. So,
well, let me stop you for a second. So you're saying the law can't be to stop at 12 and a half feet from the track. Instead, the better course for a reasonable man to take is to proceed forward knowing that anything coming from the right is definitely going to hit me.
No,
because I will not have a chance to stop if I don't stop at 12 and a half feet before this thing hits me.
Your Honor, see, that's not the record. And that's why I respectfully, you're arguing facts with me, not the law. And that's why this is a jury question and this should be affirmed. Let me just, if I might, if I could just refer the court to our visual aid in the back here, because I think this will help to illustrate. When each one of these train cars is about 60 feet long, when Charles Settle emerged from behind this pile of wood, the engine was about three cars down. It was about that's how close it was. If the train had been down here, he might have been avoided getting hit if it was way down here. So the point is, the confluence of events of how close this train was when he appeared at around that pile was really key in terms of the danger and why he was killed. But the reason why it wasn't as a factual matter, that first of all, there's no legal duty to stop. There's no ab initio legal duty to always stop, to answer your question, Justice Lemons. Number two is, as a factual matter, the predicament he had, and we presented this to the jury, was that trains came from both directions. With his truck, and we presented evidence, if he stopped at the safe point, which is 15 feet away from the rail, he would have been behind that huge stack of lumber. So then, according to your scenario, Your Honor, he has to get out of the truck, walk around, look to see if trains are coming, get back
in. That's not my scenario. My scenario is what you say in your brief on page 15, where Mr. Soto could see around the edge of the lumber toward the direction of the oncoming train. The nose of his truck was 12.5 feet from the rail.
Or most
that's what you said on the top page of page 15.
Right, and most importantly, 10 feet from the train. Right. The train. So
when he stopped, that's where he would he'd be 10
well,
feet
from
the
train. Well, he didn't stop. That is when he could see. There was no evidence that he could or did stop at that point. That was when he first could see around the wood pile. So the point is that if you're saying he should have stopped, well then the logic must be that he should have stopped at what everybody agrees was the safe point. That was when the nose of his truck was 15 feet away from the rail, not 12.5 feet. At that point, he couldn't have seen around
I don't get this the safe point. I mean, if as long as you're not going to get hit by the train, you're safe. I mean, what's 12 feet? What's 8 feet? What's 5 feet? You're safe. You're not going to get hit by the train. I don't understand that.
Well, Your Honor, it really is a judgment by the experts in the area, and it reflects this Virginia statute that says when you can see a train, you have to stop 15 feet away. It's that for most vehicles, it's very, very difficult. I mean, it's theoretically possible, but to stop and not get hit once you're in that 15-foot hazard zone.
But you're not going to get hit in the 15-foot hazard zone. I mean, even your brief says you're not going to get hit by the train.
Well,
I mean, Justice Goodwin points it out on page 15. Your brief says that he's 12.5 feet from the rails. Well, the train doesn't extend 12.5 feet from the rails.
No, it extends 2.5 feet. Correct, Your Honor. But the point is that within that hazard zone, the danger is so great. The rule of safety, as recognized even by their expert and codified in Virginia law, is that you shouldn't be closer than 15 feet. Moreover, the evidence showed that the other truck driver, Mr. Compton, also found it was safer not to stop. When you're driving a big rig like that, I mean, the fears of difficulty of starting and stopping, even if you stopped at 12.5 feet, okay, you still would have to start up again, and you have the danger of a train coming from the other direction and hitting you. So,
but isn't that the problem with the railroad having a line that has a curve coming this way on the right and a curve coming this way on the left? Why is that the lumber owner's problem that this guy might get hit by the left?
Well, it's the lumber owner's problem if, without the lumber there, there would be no problem with visibility. But even the owner of the landscaping company across the way, who was traveling back and forth, testified that, those stacks blocked visibility. So the natural condition, if you were, would be that rail spur. We have the affirmative act of the lumber company blocking the vision, not only with lumber on their property, but lumber within the right-of-way of the railroad, which the evidence said was designed in part for safety, to keep that safe area around the rails. Heavy trains moving like this, it's a very dangerous business, Your Honor. And when you've got heavy truck and dangerous trains coming together, it is a dangerous world. It is true, in a particular situation, someone might stop closer than 15 feet. But the rule that is embodied in the statute, that is that the experts and even their expert acknowledged, you should stop 15 feet away. And so,
let me ask you a follow-up on Justice Goodwin's illustration. If I put some small trees out in the front part of my house near the road, over time, hopefully if I treat them right, they'll grow. If those trees obscure vision such that somebody has to stop before they go into the to the roadway when they're leaving my driveway, am I liable?
You could be, possibly, but it's a question of fact. If the rule is using your property so as not to cause an unreasonable risk of danger, that's the law. And I would suggest that's about as far as you all can go. After that, it's the facts. Was that an unreasonable risk in that situation? What's the nature of the traffic? There's all sorts of factual questions. So this boils down to a jury question, even if Your Honor wouldn't necessarily agree with where the jury came out. So that's what I would say, Your Honor. There's no, you cannot, if you say someone can create a hazard like this and then as a matter of law get away with it, I mean, this is an ordinary negligence case. You are undermining basic protections of negligence law and jeopardizing public safety. I think that there's no way around that. The jury made a very close decision, and there was competing evidence on both sides, and they ruled the way they should. There is no basis in law for this court to overturn that. Your Honor, did I ever answer your question?
No, exactly, but I have another question for you now. Another way to look at this is, if we go along with this, we're creating liability for everybody that has property and they allow trees to grow or they put something on the property anytime that there's a line of sight problem. And we've said that there's a line of sight, there's a duty to preserve line of sight, have we?
No, Your Honor. Well, I would just return you, if you want to talk about premises liability, which is what you're edging up on, I think the discussion of this court, both in the majority and dissenting opinions in the Klein case, is very instructive, because the majority in Klein clearly said that that case did not involve the affirmative act of the landowner. It involved dead trees, as I'm sure everybody here knows, falling on someone on the highway.
That was a public highway, too. That's a distinction, too. It was a public highway. And Klein came from Fancher, which was adjacent property owners, but that was a nuisance action.
The rule of law is you have a duty not to use your property to endanger people, period. It doesn't matter if you're an invitee, a licensee, it doesn't matter if you're on a public highway or whatever. That's the rule of law. It's been the rule of law for generations. Our cases that we cite to that underscore that.
Let me see if I understand. That's the legal duty.
Right.
The next question then is, which is a factual question, and correct me if I'm wrong, as to whether you breached the duty.
Yes, Your Honor.
And so factually, in the hypotheticals that, you know, we've asked you about, you may or may not have breached the duty given the
correct,
facts
Your Honor.
Of either putting out the trees or stacking up the lumber or planting corn in a field, I mean, whatever.
What happened to Andrew?
And Justice Lemons, to return to your question about the trees, I think that fits in with the notice argument here. Notice is a proposition that comes from premises liability. The proper question here, which ultimately in their brief they start to get to, is foreseeability. And the foreseeability instruction here, again, they didn't object to. And it's whether a prudent person would foresee that the consequences of their act were dangerous. So the legal liability, even in the context you're articulating, it involves several steps, and including foreseeability.
The foreseeability question for primary negligence is also a question for contributory negligence, isn't it?
Yes, I would think
so. They have to be mirror images. So isn't the duty for him the same?
Yes, and all the evidence showed, as best as ever, everyone could see, he was driving slowly. The evidence from our side showed that there was no horn blown, that no one could really, it was totally incredible to say that the engineer and the conductor, they were the only one who testified, they could see which way he was looking. At every point of all the three points, whether it was dangerous to stop and go, we've talked about that, the horn and whether they could see him, the evidence was very much in dispute, and indeed, most of the evidence was on our side.
Well, but something that wasn't in dispute, and the only evidence on this question is that he didn't look.
No, that's not true, Your Honor.
Where is the evidence that he looked?
That the first of all, Mr. Mendoza, who was in the truck opposite, said he couldn't see Mr. Settle's face. He's up close also. A very important point that the jury looked at, and in fact, if you recall, they asked for this exhibit to come in.
I know, but my question is, where is the evidence affirmatively that he looked? There's only evidence affirmatively that he didn't.
Well, the engineer and the conductor said that they saw him. I'm sorry, I misunderstood your question.
They saw him. Of course, but he didn't see them.
Well, he said he
didn't look.
Well, no, they said that they saw at some far distance. They saw through the windows of his cab and saw he wasn't looking.
Right. And that's the only evidence on that subject.
But that's the only object of where Mr. Settle was looking. The evidence, though, relates to that is whether that testimony is credible and whether they could have seen that. That's evidence that relates to that point very clearly. So the evidence went both ways, undermining the proposition and the credibility of those two witnesses that they could have seen at that distance. Based on where they testified, they were on the floor. They pulled. I'm sorry. Wow.
Okay, thank you. I think you've answered his question. Thank you.
Thank you.
Briefly in rebuttal, there is no case, one point, Justice Goodwin, that fits this fact pattern. There's no precedent from this court that would create a duty to RGR or Justice Lemons and his hypothetical to protect sight lines. And as the questions to Mrs. Settle indicated, it is clear from the facts of this case that Mr. Settle failed to stop. At a private crossing or public crossing, Mr. Settle had duties as well.
Well, the instruction said that the driver of the vehicle had a duty to look and listen, and that was how the jury was instructed in this case.
Yes, ma'am.
They weren't instructed that he had a duty to stop.
No, but he did have a duty to look and to listen, and the evidence was clear that he did not look or listen.
Well, that's assuming that the jury believed the folks in the train.
But the... Correct, Chief.
That was a credibility call.
Right. So the evidence was that he failed to stop.
Well, but he didn't have a duty to stop under the instructions.
No, but...
I think your response is, given the facts as they are, if he didn't stop, he knew he would be hit by anything coming from his right if he didn't look.
Yes, Justice Goodwin. We'd ask you to reverse the judgment of the trial court and enter final judgment in favor of RGR, or alternatively, remand the case for a new trial.
Thank you.
Thank you.